Thank you for being here. You're here on a special day, I'll tell you that.
Why is it not working, Jonesy?
They don't want to be locked into a house or an apartment.
Got to follow the social distancing rule.
And some nuff dicks were getting tested, then going in and doing a shop.
COVID. I had it.
Detective so, George Bennett.
Yeah, he's a bell-in, absolutely.
George, don't say hello to you. Like,
I don't know, I'm actually genuinely embarrassed.
I broke my back.
A vertebrae or a portion?
Spinal.
Wait, Josie, just do that. Do that thing where you just put Bill's talking. Let me see if I can hear him first.
G'day, guys. Welcome back. As promised, we're a few days late, like normal.
I would expect.
Yeah. And we haven't got George, so.
What do you expect?
Thanks for listening. Like, share, subscribe.
We're off to a cracker. How good's the Olympics, Bills? Yeah, I'm good, mate. It's been in between shutdowns, lockdowns, but we are addicted to the games. And today, most successful day we've ever had. And it's not even finished at the Olympics in Australian Olympic history. And, geez, just seeing all these gold medals is so proud. So much effort goes into it. And as we said last step, it just means a lot. When you can stand on the top step, I mean, geez, fantastic.
Yeah.
I've always been a big fan, mate. Always.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Yeah. So should we just bring our guests?
We couldn't get George, so why not bring in a gold medalist who we respect the amount of effort that went in to get that gold, and we're so proud that he was able to do it in the year 2000. Of course, that's Scotty McGrory. Scooter, welcome. Gold medalist.
Yeah. Look, thanks for the welcome, but I call bullshit because your last episode, all I heard was you guys dishing the Olympics and who cares anyway, and standing on the top step, who wants to? Ooh, why would you bother?
Hang on.
Exactly. You can see the difference here. Like, Jonesy's tried to like brush it off like it never happened, and I couldn't even commit to the lie. Like, I was too deep in the lie last week, Jonesy. I couldn't.
Was it a lie, or was it how you felt?
I don't know, actually. I think it was a lie. It was a lie.
Oh, it is now. It is now.
My Olympic spirit is massive at the moment. As soon as the game started, like, I watched the opening ceremony and I was like, all opening ceremonies are a bit boring. You know, it's cool to see the countries coming out, but ultimately it's like... But then, like, I saw the Kiwis and you can't help but get a little bit like, oh, yeah, here's the Kiwi boys. And then as soon as the first gun went... First competition gun, mate. I'm into it. Love the games. I love it. I've always loved the Olympics.
Two-time bronze medalist, mate. You should.
That's it.
You were there in the mix.
It's been a cracker. It's been, and the cycling events are awesome. Like, yeah. I reckon. Obviously, do you want to introduce Scotty a bit, Jonesy, for everyone?
Like, okay. Scott McGrory, he won bronze in '88 in the, what was it, team pursuit?
Rhythmic gymnastics.
and then backed it up in 2000. I don't know why I didn't get a Guernsey with the Aussie team in those years between 88 and 2000, but he came back with a vengeance, won the Madison. I was there.
You want to talk about those years in between? I'll start twitching.
Yeah, what happened there? It's 12 years there.
Yeah, I couldn't be bothered. Couldn't be bothered. Yeah. It's like you guys. Couldn't be bothered to go to the Olympics. So I just decided to have 12 years off.
But I was there the night you won gold, Scooter. I was there in the velodrome. There's only, 5,000 people in the velodrome, I reckon, and, 20,000 have said that they were there to you that night.
Yeah, it's about that. It's about that. I've done the maths, and it just doesn't add up.
But back in Sydney, so the family had the trip. We're going to the games. But remember how hard it was to get tickets? But my old man said, no, you can rock up on the day, and you can buy, like, corporate tickets that aren't getting used. So we stood in this queue and got a ticket on the day. And the first event we go to, we went and saw Scooter win the gold. There was a silver medal in the Gary Neewon. And I was like, how good is this? Every event I go to, Aussies is going to win gold. Didn't quite pan out like that. But I remember the atmosphere at the time was bloody electric. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. Mitch Docker wasn't a cyclist before that day. His dad, same thing, bought some tickets random to different events and then, rocked up. They got tickets to the last day of track cycling, went in there and, the first cycling event that Mitch watched was me winning in the Madison. which is some sort of level of inspiration for him to get into bikes.
It's pretty cool to think as a kid you could go to the Olympics. So, like, everyone, obviously, it's like I grew up never having gone to Olympics to watch it, but I remember at school, you know, like watching Robert Dale win gold in Sydney in the rowing, and like that was one of the inspirational moments for me. Like, every kid has them, you know, every sports kid, or every kid really. Like, at some point they can think back to when they were 12 years old and they remember this gold medal or that gold medal. It's so cool, like, to be able to go to the Olympics. Like Mitch, as you say, 12 years old, probably sitting in the grandstand watching the track, you know, like, and it's a shame that no one can do it this year, unfortunately, but you guys be doing it in Brisbane in 12 years' time or whatever it is.
That'd be cool. But you wouldn't have, Sam, because you were in bed the time zone, but I know, Dan, you and I were watching the BMX freestyle, which there's a whole other topic there, but because the crowd has been limited for all the different events, and cycling's been one of the ones that actually has had a decent crowd because it's open air and it's out of Tokyo, so the restrictions aren't as strict. But there was a bridge across the river right next to where the BMX park was today, and that was packed, absolutely packed all the way across the bridge, because it was at least some sort of vantage point that people could get to, because they weren't allowed to get into the stadium itself. So it was amazing, actually. It was really cool to see all the Japanese that were desperate to actually watch something, you know, from afar.
It's actually amazing, like, that those, like, sport like BMX freestyle, and I didn't even really know that 3x3 basketball was in the Olympics, half-court basketball, basically. And I started, and when I saw that it was in, I was like, what a crock of shit, actually. Like, fuck, is it really an Olympic sport? And then I started reading up on it, and apparently the IOC did a study that said it's the number one played urban sport in the world. And, like, it's millions and millions and millions of people play it. I guess it's probably actually pretty obvious when you think about it. And then so I started watching. I watched the final, actually, or semi-final and the final. It's fucking awesome. It's so good.
Is it the same rules, no blood, no foul?
Yeah. No, they have, like, a little zone, I think.
That's only in Harlem. That's the rules of Harlem. Yeah. Hey, what about the other one? Have you ever seen the what was that called? It was, like, trampoline basketball.
Yeah, that's awesome. Where they're all trampolines and they just, it's like jam ball or whatever they call it. And it's just dunks and the ring's got like padding around it because it's just constant chaos. Well, like getting chopped mid-air. No, not
it's
the
not
Olympics.
No.
Slam ball, I reckon it's called.
Slam ball? I remember seeing that.
Remember that show, that rollerblading show? What was that called in like the early 90s or mid-90s? Roller jam?
Yeah.
T-Birds, mate. The T-Birds, they were the best female team. I definitely remember it. The Thunderbirds were amazing.
Yeah, and it was just like, you know how you have that American Ninja Warrior shit now? It's like kind of like that. It was like these real big, like, musty people, like, with, like, stars and stripes tattoos and, like, flags coming out of their helmet, and they'd just be on rollerblades and just fucking smashing and running to the walls and shit.
But that's should bring
Rollerball was one of my favorite movies of all time. James Caan in Rollerball. That's awesome. It's kind of like BMX, really, to be honest.
But that freestyle, you sent me a message, Scooter, going, hey, you're watching the freestyle. And I'm like, oh, mate, I've watched enough swimming. I'm bloody over it. And then when I saw 7-2 and it's freestyle BMX, I was like, oh, shit, I'll give this a go. And some of the tricks, like the Aussie bloke obviously won gold, but it was his second run that blew me away. Like, and this guy designed his own park in his backyard. And that trick, Scooter, where he flipped the bike and caught it, I was like, mate, I couldn't even do that on the computer game. Like, you know, when you could get Matt Hoffman's BMX, that's when you're busting out all the tricks for max points. That was taking the piss. Like, that was next level.
Yeah, Logan Martin. So the Gold Coast is like it's the epicenter now of freestyle BMX. So Lupus was the other former world champion who blew his knee out at the Worlds this year, so he didn't get to go to the games, Brandon Lupus. But he's from Sydney and moved to the Gold Coast to train with the guys because the Oz Cycling set up have built a couple of parks for Natalia Diem, who was our female rider. I think she was fifth. Logan Martin, who won. And it's really become an epicenter. Now, before the Brisbane Olympic Games were announced, the state government had already made a commitment to build an extreme sports park complex for a training facility at Metricon Stadium on the Gold Coast, which is, you know, the AFL football stadium. We have a massive area there. So they're going to build this extreme sports complex there to train people for rock climbing, I think skateboarding and then freestyle BMX as well. Now we've got the Olympics coming to Brisbane. That's going to get even more funding. So we're going to just create and develop these amazing, you know, freestyle type of riders and skateboarders. They're going to look at BMX racing to try and get people to come across to freestyle, but also gymnastics. They're going to start looking at gymnasts just because of the tricks that are involved and see if they can come across and also get into BMX freestyle as well. So that it's just going to take off.
Well, Aussies have obviously won enough gold to sink a bloody ship at the moment. How's New Zealand going, Bills?
Pretty good. Pretty good, actually. I think New Zealand was, they were predicting 16 medals. And I think we've got about 8 now. We cleaned up on the rowing like we always do. But the rowing was unbelievable. So we won gold in a couple of events that we were expected to. Emma Twigg, she won the single sculls, which was awesome for her because I actually went to Beijing with her and London. And she was, I think she was like 8th or 9th in Beijing, and then she was 4th in London, and then she was 4th in Rio.
She wasn't playing the guitar in the village, was she?
No. She was probably, she was at the pub with us, actually. She's a good sort. And then she finally won the other day. So she won gold in the single scales. We won gold in the doubles. And then the women's eight were the favourites to win the gold. And obviously in rowing, the eight is like the blue ribbon event, you know, it's like the 100-meter sprint and the athletics. And so the time zone shit here for us, real shit for a lot of finals. So it was at like 3 a.m. or something. So I didn't watch it, but I woke up in the morning expecting to, you know, let's go on to see if the chicks had won the women's eight. So I went on there and I was like, oh, women's eight silver. I was like, ah, oh, shit. Then I scrolled down. I was like, men's eight gold. It's like, what the fuck? Like they literally qualified by the hair of their teeth for the Olympics. They had to go to the far ends of the world to some obscure regatta to just try to get enough points to qualify for the Olympics. This was only like 6 months ago or something. They qualified for the Olympics and then they went through the repechage rounds to make the final of the Olympics and then they won. They won the gold. Boom.
Are they going to really cash in on that in New Zealand? Because we had the awesome foursome in Australia. Suddenly they're the face of like tin peaches and all this sort of shit. How big did New Zealand turn these sort of stories into like the big posters after the Olympics?
Well, we've already sort of got those with rowing because rowing's been such a marquee event for New Zealand for like, you know, 2 or 3 Olympic cycles now where we win countless golds. We started in Sydney, we won golds in basically everywhere since then. And we have got Hamish Bond, who you'll know, Scotty. He raced the time trial at the Commonwealth Games a few years ago, won silver there. But he's like the most famous rowers in New Zealand. So he's won 2 Olympic gold medals previously in the pair with Eric Murray. And then after London, Eric Murray retired. So Bondi went back to cycling and sort of won the national time trial title again. And then he's decided, oh, I'll go back to rowing. I want to do one more Olympics. I'm not going to go as a cyclist. He tried to go as a cyclist, realized that he wasn't going to go for bike riding. So he's like, oh, I'll go to the Olympics for rowing again, but I've lost my partner in crime, who they were undefeated for 7 or 8 years or something, like the, you know, the best rowing pair of all time. He's like, oh, I'll go to the eight. You know, we haven't had an eight for a while. Let's try and qualify the eight. So he's been in the eight and now they've obviously won the gold. So now he's the first New Zealand athlete in history to win gold medals in 3 Olympics. So I'd say he'll be on the tin peaches, Jonesy, to answer your question.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what a gun.
How good was it overnight, Scooter, with the 100 metres, the sprints, the young Aussie that, like, won the heat and now everyone is just fizzing. Like, we've never had a 100-metre sprinter and he's come out and wins the heat from lane one, doesn't even get an introduction. And, mate, everyone is going to be up watching tonight the final because, like, yeah, this is as good as it gets in terms of Aussie excitement.
It's the 100-metre final tonight, today.
Tonight, yeah, so in, you know, 5 hours' time.
8.
Oh, nice.
Semis are in 3 hours
or less.
Yeah, and then the finals 2 hours after that.
Yeah, so semis aren't 2 races, though. Semis are 4 races or something like that. That's a weird thing they do in running. But, yeah, the Jamaican in the middle, that was middle lanes, it was second fastest in that heat. You know, we kind of had to look across to say, well, hang on a minute, like, I don't recognise that outfit because it's Australian uniform and this is sprinting. We haven't seen that since whenever.
Yeah.
And I think it was 1956, the Melbourne Olympics, is the last time we've actually had an Australian in the 100-metre final. And Matt Shervington's the last time we've had someone in the semis, and that was in 2000. So that's how long it's been. So all of these top-line sprinters, they've never seen an Australian get this far. And he's young, right? So this guy's going to get quicker and quicker. He should.
What's his name, Mark? Is it Matt Newcomb? I don't even remember.
I don't know.
He's that big.
he's big, we forget his name.
I'm going to have to Google this.
It's only been a day. We've only heard of him for a day. So, yeah, it hasn't stuck in yet.
That's cool.
You know, you mentioned freestyle. Sorry, go, Beals.
No, you go. Mine was not important.
Well, this is the thing, right? So you
Rowan Browning.
Rowan Browning is him, right? Yeah, yep. Of course. Yeah,
what did you say, Jonesy? Matt Hancock or something?
Matt Newcomb.
Newcomb.
Close.
Yeah.
Samson. Okay. I was way off.
I was way off. Swanson.
Anyway. You know when we said BMX freestyle before and you said, oh, I thought we were talking about the swimming, right?
Yeah.
So I got a theory on this, right? Now, swimming's great for Australia because we win so much, okay? A lot of other parts of the world, there's no one swimming, right? It's just not happening, right, as a sport. Now, and cycling, I get that as well, okay, because it can be a sport of opportunity because of the price, the cost that it takes to get involved in it. However, what we don't do in cycling or pretty much any other sport, and perhaps the one exception would be the race walk in athletics, right, because walking's obviously not as fast as running. Everything else you do is to run as fast as you possibly can, whether it's 100 metres, 10,000 metres or a marathon, okay, except for the race walk. That's the one event. Cycling, we've got a lot of drafting and everything else that plays into it tactically, right? So we've got multiple events. It's still about who gets the line the fastest possible way, right, however you want to create that. Swimming, the fastest way to swim is freestyle, right? There's no question of that, right? Yet you've still got backstroke, breaststroke and butterfly. When you break it down, we've got a massive team of swimmers that get to go. There's always a fight over how many athletes can go from different sports. We always get compromised. We've got mountain bikers that ride the road race for us because we can't have enough and all these sorts of crossover things that happen. Yet the swimmers get to fill the team with 30-something competitors, whatever it may be. And the one stroke that's the fastest is the freestyle. Right? So I feel that, like, no one goes down to the pool. When's the last time you guys went down to the pool for a bit of a leisurely butterfly? No one can butterfly. Unless you're a competitive swimmer at the top level, no one does butterfly.
Although, I'll cut you off, the walk, the power walk, that's me when I've got a turtle head down at Caulfield Park.
Yeah, right, okay.
It's the same action.
Yeah. Well, no, I don't want to disrespect them because it is bloody hard, right? Yeah. But then you've got the backstroke. My theory on that is that's the stroke that people do when they're training drowning. On an outdoor No, when they're training in an outdoor pool, all they're trying to do is actually even up their tan, right? Because they've been doing their freestyle training, which is what they're supposed to do, but they've just got a what's it called? The white and dark chocolate. It's the chop top or whatever
deck,
it is, or the
top deck.
Top deck, right? So they've got to even their tan up, so they do a bit of backstroke just to get some sun on the belly, right? Mm. And then you've got breaststroke, which really the only time you ever really do breaststroke is when you're up at Hamilton Island and you're at the pool and you just want to cruise across to the bar, you just breaststroke across to get yourself another drink. Get rid of them all, just do freestyle, have all the different distances. It gets rid of the medley relays, it gets rid of all that rubbish, and you've just got the fastest stroke done. And then that brings the numbers of swimmers down to 10 from 30-something per country.
And then just do it over all the distances, 50, 100, 200,
400, do all the distances. Yeah, of course, Male, female, all the distances, parity across it all, but get rid of all those other three strokes, get rid of the medley relays, all that stuff.
I'd love to talk about the evolution of swimming strokes. Like, how do you reckon freestyle's obvious because that's just the most obvious stroke to get from A to B in water. Backstroke, I always thought it was just there for when you got tired and you need to flip over so you could breathe. Breaststroke, why did they invent breaststroke? Not make a splash so the sharks don't eat you or something?
No, it's when you've just had your hair done or, you know, you're trying to protect your head generally, but they still dunk it. But like that doggy, it's the original doggy paddle.
Mm.
And butterfly. Yes, butterfly. Where's that come from?
Yeah, that's fucking stupid, butterfly. Yeah.
So the equivalent to that, right, is so you're allowing slower strokes than the fastest way of doing it to come in. It would be like saying, when we had high jump, okay, when we came through the evolution of high jump, it used to be doing the scissors. So that's how they would get over the bar until Frosby came along and developed the Frosby flop. That became the highest. Now, we still don't have a scissors competition. We've just gone and evolved into the Frosby flop. That's the highest, right? Mm. So what with the swimming, all those other strokes, it's basically like having a high jump competition with the Frosby flop and a scissors competition as well as a separate medal event, which is we don't do that, do we?
No, I see what you mean. It's and like the whole the motto of the Olympics is what is it? Stronger, faster, higher, whatever. Faster, fitter, stronger, higher, or whatever. Yeah, you know,
unless it's swimming, and then you got three strokes where it's not fast.
Yeah. And I was watching this documentary last night on Eurosport here. They've got these what do they call it? Like some history of the Olympics, and they focus on like specific sports over the course of the history, basically. And they had one with started with like Jesse Owens, went through Carl Lewis into Usain Bolt. And then I was watching the swimming one last night with Phelps. And I knew Phelps won a shitload of medals, but I didn't realize he'd won 28 Olympic medals, 23 of which are gold. 23 Olympic gold medals that guy's got. That's fucking unbelievable. And obviously the reason he's got it is exactly what you say, Scooter, is because he won eight golds in Beijing. So there's eight events there, you know, that he's done. He's able to do so many events, like a track cyclist, like Chris Hoy or Wiggins or whatever. Like, it's actually pretty amazing how many medals they've won, considering that they can only really do one or two events per Olympics. Mm. Phelps has done eight at one. And I used to be a bit like against that, kind of like, that's actually shit, you know. Swimmers can win so many medals because they've got so many opportunities, they've got so many events. But then, like last night when I was watching it back, I was like, yeah, he had a lot of opportunities and yeah, he had a lot of events. But the reality is he won them all, you know, and he wasn't the only one in those events. Like you say, these teams have got 30 swimmers, you know, so he's not only so much better than anybody else in America to get the gig in all those events, but then he's so much better than everybody else in the world that's also got a massive pool of swimmers. So even though he had all these opportunities, the fucking guy still won them all, you know?
Oh, you can't begrudge the individuals. There's nothing against it. Like any of these backstrokers or I'm not begrudging any of them. The events are there, so they qualify, they go there, they win them. So it doesn't matter, right? It's like, you know, when someone says, it's like when Nibali won the Tour de France. Oh, yeah, but Froome and Contador crashed out. So they crashed out. They shouldn't have crashed out. You know, you can only beat who is there. So I don't begrudge the athletes at all that come through and win. But it's kind of like saying, so Philippe Ogana, right, the fastest individual pursuit rider in the world. There is no individual pursuit at the Olympics anymore. But it would be like saying if there was, we'll have a 3,000-metre pursuit, a 4,000-metre pursuit and a 5,000-metre pursuit plus the team pursuit. There's four gold medals that he could win.
Yeah.
Now, that's kind of the equivalent to swimming. No one's going to say, oh, well, Ogana, you know, he shouldn't be able to win so much. Well, if the events are there, yeah, absolutely. And Phelps, if you compare it to other sports – look, he is definitely the greatest swimmer of all time. But if you compared it to the opportunities in running, okay, so it was when Michael Johnson won the 200 metres and the 400 metres back-to-back at Olympics, that was extraordinary because there's no way he could win the 100 and there's no way he could win the 800 because they're so far apart. Mm. So the 100 and the 200 you can win, 200, the 400 you can win, 400, 800, probably not. 800, 1500, yeah, it's a possibility. So it's just not comparable. Swimming's not comparable to all the other sports and the opportunities they get.
Why do you think that the Olympics has or the swimming has survived with all your events? Obviously, like we've seen in cycling over recent years, the removal of the kilo, the removal of the individual pursuit.
Yeah.
Okay, they brought in, I think they brought in an event maybe, didn't they? But ultimately it's like a time saver, you know, like we need to get rid of a couple of events, we need to make the program shorter, you know, we get less athletes because of that. But swimming survives, and swimming starts on day one. It's still fucking going now, you know, like it goes for 10 days or 2 weeks or something. Do you think that's purely financial, like because so many people watch swimming?
I think it's – so it comes down to power base, right? So all of these decisions are made by the IOC, and so it's completely up to the IOC and the members of the IOC when they have their vote as to what sports come in and out and what extra disciplines come in or go out. And cycling for a long time didn't have a voice on the IOC, and you also had the drug tainted era, which meant that whatever voice they thought they might have had gets weakened because they're not going to listen to cycling because of the challenges, that we were having through that period. So no voice, and even any voice we had was a whisper, if that.
Yeah.
So the IOC could steamroll this particular sport. Swimming's got a really strong voice, so they've added. You know, they the other day they had the mixed relay. So male and females doing the relay. I was listening to the commentary of it, you know, legitimate commentators, Ian Thorpe, Liesl Jones, and Basil Semplis as the lead. And you could even hear when they were commentating that they weren't taking it as seriously as the other events. You could just hear that in the commentary. So even they didn't think that it was, you know, as legitimate as some of the other events that are in there. It's still a gold medal. Who cares? Yeah. The event's there, train for it, go for it, win it, and it's still legitimate because it's in the Olympics. And I think rowing's another one that's got a really strong voice on the IOC as a really traditional sport as well. So, yeah, they'll never lose events either. Not that I want them to, but, yeah, it comes down to who is on the IOC. And, for example, fencing, which is a really small sport now globally, it'll never go out of the Olympics because the boss of the IOC is a former fencer.
Yeah, right.
And there are two members on the actual board that were fencers at the Olympics. Of course, that sport's never going to go out. I'm not saying it should, but I just know politically it'll never be removed as long as you've got two fencers that are making the decisions.
And I guess swimming has the superstars as well, eh? Like cycling doesn't have the superstars. Primoz Roglic wins a time trial. You know, there's a handful of there's more people that know Primoz Roglic now after he won the time trial. But before that, only bike riders knew Primoz Roglic, really, probably every single Slovenian in the world. But other than that, like, they're not superstars like swimming. Like, Michael Phelps winning 8 Olympic gold medals was nothing but great for the Olympics, for their marketing.
Yeah, you know, like, yeah,
look, true. Look at that, man. The superstar of 1-8 gold medals, you know? And everyone knows
it. Yeah, Spinks, Mark Spinks as well, Ian Thorpe, you know, all these guys. Yeah, absolutely. You know, they are creating legends, which then carries that sport forward, you know, into the future as well. So that's why, you know, they were like, I think swimming's had, so the women had the 800 meter included, no, sorry, the 1500 meter included this time, and the men had the 800 meter included. So there's two new events that they got, plus the mixed relay a couple of Olympics ago had the open water swim added also. You know, in the meantime, we lost the 1000 meter time trial and 500 meter time trial to bring in BMX. And I actually agree that BMX should have come in, but I don't think it should have been at the expense of other track cycling medals, because while BMX, you know, artistic cycling, you know, bicycle, football, all these things come under the UCI banner as cycling, but BMX racing and BMX freestyle, it's as far removed from track cycling or road cycling as boxing is. You know, it just happens to be on a bike. It's got nothing to do with, and they don't see themselves as cyclists. They see themselves as BMXers. So yeah, we're losing events while other sports are gaining some. Yeah, but the Madison's back in, so that's the thing that I'm most excited about. At least we're starting to maybe rectify that a little bit.
But I'm all chips in on these spectator sports. Like, as Bewley said, when you see it on paper, you go, BMX, really? And then when you watch it, you go, holy shit, how's this not been in for the last, you know, 20 years? That should be the focus, because at the end of the day, it's entertainment. So if there's any sports as boring as batshit, piss them off.
That's the big argument, eh? Like, the Olympics simply is, like, their motto is, I can't remember exactly, but it's like stronger, faster, higher or whatever, you know? And it started with a bunch of nude fucking Greek dudes throwing a heavy ball into a field, you know, and like whoever had the strongest arm and the smallest cock, I guess, won, you know. And
get the tape measure out. He loses points. He's got a pin dick.
Like that's what the Olympics is about, you know. So run fast, swim fast, throw hard, throw far. But then you come into the modern era now where, you have 3x3 basketball, you have freestyle, BMX, you have surfing, you've got rock climbing coming up, which I'm actually pretty G'd for.
I'm looking forward to that.
How does that work? Hang on, stop. Rock climbing, how do they get it? Time to the top.
So you get, I think you get like 30 seconds to look at the wall. So you're not allowed to see the wall before it. You're not allowed to recon it or anything.
Oh, that's cool.
And like, and just before the start, you get like 30 seconds to look at the wall and go, okay, I'm going to go there, and then you just stopwatch, mate, fastest to the top. Boom.
Sounds like a challenge off Survivor.
Yeah.
Actually, when's Survivor on? There's two. So you've got speed climbing, which is that, just flat. They're running up the wall. It's extraordinary to see how quick they get up them. But then there's bouldering, which is
lower.
Shorter. Yeah, it's lower, but really technical, really difficult. So they're doing it slowly, but they're just, you know, contortionists trying to get up there. So both very different, but I find them both really fascinating. You know, the skill level of both is great.
And that actually, and rock climbing actually fits the Olympic mold of strength, agility, like, you know, like ultimately the strongest or the fastest is going to win. It's not a judged event like a lot of things.
Most countries have got a rock too. That helps.
Yeah.
We got a big one out in the middle. We're not allowed to climb it though. Out in the middle of Australia.
Yeah, Ayers Rock.
That's where that was our rock climbing training facility, but we're buggered now. We've got to build another another Uluru. Right. The big change though that we're noticing now, which is, you know, the BMX and the freestyle and all these things coming in, skateboarding, et cetera, is that the IOC have to evolve with the way sport has evolved. You got a lot of traditionalists that crack their shits because, you know, BMX freestyle comes in or skateboarding or whatever it might be.
But they need the viewers. They need the viewers and they need the money.
Yeah, and that's why there is a lot of discussion around video gaming.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right? Now, I'm not a big fan of video gaming coming into the Olympics, but it was in the Asian Games a couple of years ago.
Oh, it'd be huge.
And it's a massive, massive sport. So the IOC legitimately are looking at how they could actually bring that in. The other side of that, right, so big sport, lots of people do it, of course, but if they were to design from the IOC's perspective, now I'm not agreeing with this, right, but if they were to actually be involved with a game developer to develop the particular game that they are going to play within the Olympics and then the revenue from that, which we're talking billions of dollars, aren't we, for video gaming, and especially the one that will get you into the Olympics, that's going to have everybody buying it and playing it, then they're going to make more money out of having video gaming in the Olympics than any of the other sports.
Yeah, but the problem is, Billy was talking about marketability of like your Michael Phelps wins 8 gold medals. Imagine the marketability of a fat guy who's 28, lives at home with mum, covered with zits, he's got man boobs, he's pushing $1.80, and he's a gold medalist. You know, how do you market that?
Like, I honestly don't agree with every single sport in the Olympics. I don't agree with some of the sports I've brought in recently, all of them. But at the same time, I can see why they're there. You know, I can see clearly why they're there. You know, they attract 3x3 basketball, for example, largest urban sport in the world. It's obviously make millions of people are watching this. You know, maybe we aren't, but there's a shitload more people that are. You know, all these sports. You know, yeah, I can see the reason why. But then ultimately, when you draw a line through the sand, they're all still sports. You still all have to be fit. You know, you have to train and you have to be fit. Video gaming can fuck off out of the Olympics, like.
Yeah, but it comes out of money, bro. It's money, bro. You can't fight the almighty dollar.
It's not a sport. Like, there's no room. The only reason it's going to be in there is for money. But, like,
twisted is it's a competition.
But it's not an Olympic sport. It's not an Olympic game. It's Olympic sports. Like, okay, it's a game, I suppose. Olympic
bro,
game,
have you ever have you ever gone on a like 64-hour straight bender on a video game? You're pumping in the Red Bulls. It's hard, man. You've got to fight the demons, you've got to fight fatigue. These guys are athletes. Their fingers, their calluses on their thumbs and their fingers, like this is pure strength. Mental and physical
game.
Finger strength.
I've got this game called Wudoku on my phone. That's the only gaming device I have. And I've got a new journey to do actually. Adventure's waiting.
what are you doing? What are you doing with Wudoku?
Because let's it's go simple.
Full straight on this shit. What
it's
are you
all
doing?
I have. It's all I have. It's Tetris.
Oh right,
you know.
Oh right,
and that is a world championship. You can do world championship.
I was watching that recently. Actually, I watched that online. The Tetris.
It's the only game I have on my phone or in any part of my life, and I purely have it to kill time on flights. But no,
I'm with you. I'm totally with you. I understand why the IOC would want gaming in, because there is a genuine revenue stream by having ownership or a part ownership in the game that will get played or the games that will get played, right? And it could make them billions of dollars. That's why I feel that they would want to do it, and because it's such a big thing around the world. I do not agree with it actually coming in, though, because I don't think it has a place in an athletic event.
And you know what? Like I probably went a bit heavy when I said the gaming can off. Like, I probably went in a bit hot, a bit heavy, you know, but ultimately, I guarantee, and I challenge the listeners, and I challenge anyone out there, there will be no controversy over that comment that I made, because there won't be a single person that listens to the show that will go, actually, Bills, you're wrong, mate. I really agree with gaming coming to the Olympics. I challenge the listeners to genuinely...
I say bring it in just for the contrast at the, like, opening ceremony with all these fit athletes and this stack of nerds.
Some dude eating a pack of the Cheetos.
Yeah. He's just sitting there going, oh, got to get myself ready for the march. Like, popping Zeus. That'd be awesome, mate. It'd be awesome. I'll bring it on. Bring it on. Nah.
Yeah. Sorry I brought it up.
Scooter, on a more serious note, give us some insight because you've obviously won a gold medal. What is it like in terms of, it's obviously a goal, but when you achieve that goal, is it everything that you would have thought it would have been and some, or what is it like?
Absolutely. Like if you come into any sport, you know, at this level, and look, cycling's a sport, rowing similar, triathlon as well, you know, put those three sort of in the same sort of mix, that you cannot get to the top in an easy way, right? It takes so much work and sacrifice and so many years and setbacks to come through. And sure, there are some people that pop up and do it, you know, relatively easily. Look, today Pogacar wins the Tour de France at 21, you know, so his journey hasn't been very long, but his level of commitment to the sport would be the same as any champion that has preceded him. And when you're trying to climb that mountain and, you know, in terms of the Olympics, and maybe there's a lot of road cyclists that are dreaming of the Tour de France rather than the Olympics now, but, you know, if you've come through a track cycling background or gymnastics or whatever it may be, it's the Olympics. And as a kid, it's in you to want to go there. For me, I kind of fell into the games. I was only a kid when I went to my first Olympics, and the process within the sort of 2 to 3 years before the games as a 15-year-old happened really quickly, you know, win state championships, go to a national championships, win there, break a record. Coach says, hey, you want to come to the AIS? Yeah, sure, I'll come there. That's all right, boom, go to the AIS, go to a world championships. The next year's the Olympic Games. Shit, I'm at the Games and I'm 18. Mm-hmm. Now, that happened really quickly. So I can look back on that now and think that I didn't really, or know that I didn't really have a true understanding or comprehension of what it should take and what it really, the process should be like. And the hard work and the struggles that you're supposed to go through to get to a Games. I came away with a team pursuit bronze medal. After that, I thought, shit, I'm good enough to win one of these bloody things, okay, but didn't get to go to another Games for 12 years. So the struggle came, but it was after I actually got the realization that I was good enough to maybe win. And then eventually, you know, I didn't think I'd ever get back there. You know, I had challenging situation where I didn't get along with the national coach. He'd been part of that system for such a long time. I was never going to get my way back in there. By the time we got to the 96 Olympics, I didn't even bother to try and to try out for the Games. And in all honesty, I probably wouldn't have made the team pursuit team if I did. But the next Games, which was Sydney, they had the Madison. It came in for the first time. And I'd been off being a professional Madison rider. So as soon as that was announced, in my head it was like all of a sudden that dream that I'd forgotten about, it was back again. Holy shit, I actually now have a chance to go back to the Olympic Games. It was magnified now because I finally had a taste of it. You know, I had a taste of it so long prior, which gave me that level of understanding of what it really means, and then was denied the chance in 92, denied the chance in 96, which made me really respect the people that actually get to go to them and actually have the chance to actually go to multiple Olympic Games and be successful. So by the time I got to Sydney and won, and Buells understands this as well, anyone that goes into a major event like the Olympic Games as part of a team, so for me it was with Brett Aitken. With Buells it was, you know, three or four other riders, you know, in the team pursuit group. You take on their level of responsibility as well. You know, it's not just about you. And, okay, if you stuff up, oh, well, it's disappointing. If you stuff up, you're costing someone else their dream and their lifelong dream. So I took that level of responsibility into Sydney with me as well. And it was a little bit overwhelming, you know, challenging build-up to the Games it was for me. But yet I thought that I was going to let Brett Aitken down. I didn't think I was going to have what it took at the last moment, which obviously we did. But, you know, it was Brett's dream and I'm now responsible for his dream, you know, and there's a lot you've got to take on board with that. And eventually we came away and we got the win. And it's not just, oh, yeah, there's a Games on this year, I'll go and ride it, you know. It's something that just builds up over time and over years. And, yeah, look, the biggest thing in cycling is the Tour de France. It's not the Olympic Games. Winning the road race at the Olympic Games is awesome and it's incredibly awesome, but it's still overpowered by winning the Tour de France each year, okay? So we know that as a sport. Yet for me, I was never going to win a Tour de France. You know, my best opportunity to do something, you know, incredible in this sport was at the Olympic Games. And for every person that goes there, whether it is in whatever discipline of swimming it is, whatever it may be, it's been their lifelong dream is to get to an Olympic Games and compete. So it's incredibly meaningful.
There's probably only like, when you think about it just quickly off the top of my head, there's probably cycling, rugby, football, tennis. Probably the only four sports at the Olympics that are superseded by another event in the same sport. The Olympics is the pinnacle.
Yeah, you basketball know? Probably basketball. Like playing yeah. probably basketball. Like, but it's not a national thing, is it? So it's not, and it's not an individual thing. But still, the NBA when the NBA is probably going to be seen as something bigger. Certainly financially, like if you could be you could play for whatever and win the Olympics in whatever country, you're not going to get paid as much as if you played for an NBA team that wins. And into the NBA, an NBA championship, but you're right.
What I want to focus on a little bit from what Scotty just said then was he talked about when you're in a team. So like when appearing with Brett Aitken and the Madison, like you're responsible for their destiny as well. Do you know what a real example of that is? And it's, I don't mean to pinpoint Australia, but the
go for it.
2 days ago in the 10,000 meter final, I don't know if you saw it, the men's 10,000 meter final. There was an Australian guy there, and he was obviously
cooked,
having a crack. You know, and then with one lap to go, he literally like he was unsteady on his legs. He couldn't hold himself up. You saw him come down the home straight like he was completely empty. Like he'd killed himself to try to win an Olympic medal. He probably knew he wasn't going to. He's like, I'm all in. I'm going to go until I can't stand anymore, which is what he did. And he'd come down the home straight. He's like wobbling. It's obviously hot. He's dehydrated. He collapses on his face. He gets up. He scatters down the home straight to get to the finish line. And everyone goes, oh, fuck, good on you, man. Like he gave it everything he had, you know. And then him collapsing didn't affect anybody other than him. Take it back to the rowing when that woman.
Oh,
Lay down Sally.
Yes. Like
she did exactly the same thing as that guy. Went to the depths of exertion where she couldn't paddle anymore.
Great point, Bill. This is a great point.
Completely fucked. She couldn't row anymore and she collapsed. But she cost seven other people an Olympic medal. And it's viewed in a completely different light to that 10,000 meter runner, you know?
So my point is, I always said I was never destined to win a gold because I'd just be happy with a tracksuit. I'd be happy to run that kit in Girona for 4 years after I made the games, right? If I knew that I couldn't win the 10,000, I would almost stage the leg wobblies and all this sort of stuff just because I've always been about the marketing and the interviews and all that sort of stuff, so that I can have that moment where people go, Jonesy, you didn't win. You're never going to win, but geez, you're a fighter. I'm not going to get that by just trickling over the line, coming in, you know, 21st place. I'm going to get it from the leg wobbles, the hit the deck. You know, there's a classic story of my mate when he was playing AFL footy. And he went out in a bender on a Wednesday night and had training on the Thursday morning. And he was hungover as fuck. And they were doing a time trial. And they did the time trial and he's crook as a dog. And then he finished the time trial and leaned over and started spewing. And the coach goes, see, boys, this is what I'm talking about. You got to run till it hurts. He was a legend. He was a bloody legend. There's a lesson in that for all the listeners out there. If you're going to lose, put on a show.
But that's the difference between an Olympic athlete's mentality and your mentality. So he had the leg wobbles, but he ran himself to the leg wobbles, whereas you're just going to fucking make it up.
I'm going
to
throw it. I'm going to throw
just
it.
Just run as hard as you can like he did.
Well, I'm not going to name names, but I know of a professional cyclist in the mid-2000s who went out on a bender in the middle of a grand tour. And there was a sprint coming up and he was crook as shit. And he was a sprinter. And there was a crash with like 2K to go. And he just reckons he supermanned into the back of the crash so he didn't contest the sprint because he was too hungover. So it does happen in sport, mate. It does happen.
Hey, I'll give you my version of that. So Madison World Championships. I was riding with Graham Brown. This was like 2002 or something like that. Got food poisoning. So the Madison's on the Sunday, last day of the championships. I got food poisoning Friday night at dinner, and there were two of the girls in the team got food poisoning as well. All day Saturday in bed.
Can I just cut you off? What did you eat?
I can't remember. I cannot remember. But the three of us got it. It was something, so I spent the whole Saturday in bed in my room, curtains drawn, and I was just going back and forth to the bathroom. And then by Saturday night, the coach, Ian McKenzie, came into the room to check on me, and he just walked in the room and he's just like, "Oh God!" Like, the, you know, the room just stunk or whatever. So he opened up the windows, and I was pretty crook. And I wasn't going to give up my spot. I wanted, you know, it's Madison. I won the Olympics. I wanted to ride the Madison, which maybe it's selfish, whatever. But then we get to the Sunday morning, and I woke up and I felt fine. It's like, you know, it was just in and out, basically, went through my body. And I was in and out, get up the next morning, and I'm like, okay, you know what? I feel okay. I feel like that was it, you know, whatever. Anyway, go and do a warm-up at the track, and my legs felt a little bit soft. And then when we started, I was actually on the starter. So when we rolled off, I've gone half a lap, like, out of the saddle, just sort of winding up through the bend, and I thought, oh, shit. Like, I had nothing. I could feel in my legs there was just nothing there, right? So, you know, obviously 24 hours of just shitting and pissing and vomiting, and, you know, I was pretty crook. So I had nothing in the legs, and it was one of the hardest races I've ever done, because I, you know, I felt like I was at 50%. And it got to the point where once the race really got going really quickly, it gets going, and I was just in the red. Instead of, like, in a Madison, you go into the red and under, you know, up, in and out, in and out, in and out. You can balance it all the way through. I went into the red, and I just peaked. I just stayed there, had no recovery, and got to the point where I felt that I was going to spew, like your mate in footy, and I felt like I was going to spew, and I thought, oh, awesome, because if I do spew, because then they've got to clean the track, right, because I'm going to have vomit all over the track, so I'll have to neutralise the race, clean the track.
Carrot sweep.
Yeah, and I'm thinking to myself, this is good. This will give me all I need, maybe, is just that little bit of time, 5 minutes, just to bring my heart rate down, and then I might be okay. And I was disappointed because I didn't vomit, but that's what I wanted to do, was vomit. And I actually was following the wheel of the French and looking at him thinking, these pricks are going to go now. They're going to attack. I could read the race and see it was about to happen, and they've attacked and taken a lap and they end up winning the race. I couldn't even follow them.
But what's another amazing about your gold medal story is people see you win the gold and they go, oh, yeah, they're the best guys on the day. Yep, sweet. And obviously there's a lot of stuff that was going on behind the scenes, but even to qualify for the Madison, wasn't there a race where there was a massive crash, and just to get to qualify to the Olympics, you were lucky because there was a commissaire or someone that looked after you guys in the lead-up race or whatever?
Well, sort of, yes. It was the World Championship the year before. So back then the qualifying was the Worlds, which would have been, so 1999, maybe September, October, something like that, and that was it, right? So the top 14 teams went through, and there was one other team that got selected to make 15 at the Olympics through whatever UCI selection process they had, but it wasn't through the world. So top 14 there. And we thought, okay, I was brought into the team basically to make sure that we qualified for the Olympics, not necessarily to win the world championships, but it was about making sure we got the quota, maximum quota for all the events and track cycling. Now, Brett and I thought, well, stuff that, okay, that's sure, that's our ultimate goal, but why not win it as well? And we were in second place. I just got relegated from a sprint. I chopped one of the guys accidentally on purpose in a sprint.
Standard.
Yeah, and got relegated from winning that sprint, and which put us into second place. Otherwise, we would have been in first place. And then directly after that sprint, Brett crashed. So Brett crashed, landed on his head, split it open, knocked himself out. And when I've come around and I've realised, oh, shit, Brett's out, and I've looked down at the national coach, right, back then, and he's just given me this signal. He did this, like, you know, he's out, and I'm looking at him thinking it was still 10Ks to go in the World Madison Championship, 60K race, so we'd race 40Ks, or 50K, sorry, at that point. And I'm looking at Brett on the ground, unconscious, coach is doing this, and I'm thinking, well, bugger, that's it, you know, we're not going to win the Worlds, because I was so focused at that point on if we win the we just want to win the Worlds, because that takes care of the qualification. We want to be world champions. The race is now over. And then one of my best mates and mentors, the late Manfred Doniger, who was a former top-line German rider, you know, rode the Olympics a couple of times as well, and he was the chief commissaire at those world championships. He knew what was at stake. I still had to qualify to make sure that, you know, I had to finish the race to qualify for the Olympics. So I've rolled around and let the peloton come through underneath. And then he's looked at me and just screamed at me to get back into the race. And with him saying that, now the national coach didn't say it, but with the commissaire doing that, because he's a mate, I realized, oh, shit, that's right. There's this other thing we have to do, isn't it, is to qualify for the Olympics. So when the next time they came around, I jumped in, and then I had to stay in the race, you know, the final 10 kilometres of the World Madison Championships just to hang in there and try and get through to the end. But in that crash, we'd lost a lap. I've looked up at the board, got, you know, six laps to go or seven laps to go or something, and I've looked up, and we were still sitting in, I think, third place on points. In my head, I didn't realise that they hadn't docked us the lap that we'd gone down. So we're actually a lap behind. So we're actually further down the rankings. And I was thinking to myself, if I follow the right wheel here, I was on Bruno Risi, Swiss superstar. If I follow Bruno and he gets into the points, and if I can just hang here with him, we might still run third. We can still get a medal in this. And I've ridden the last 10Ks on my own. How cool will I be if I can do that? And then as soon as they've accelerated, like, you know, five laps to go, getting ready for the last sprint, I just pop straight off the wheel and thought, freaking idiot. You're supposed to see if you can hang him, you know, they're going over 65 Ks an hour for the last bloody, you know, 15 laps. There's no way. But anyway, across the line. And then they adjusted the scoreboard and it popped up that we finished 13th because we'd lost the lap. So we only scraped into the Olympics, finishing inside the top 14 when we were there trying to win the thing. So we only just got in to qualify. But what that meant is when we went through to the games the next year, Channel 7, the host broadcaster, they look at what the medal chances are for all the different sports. And then they go to the World Championships the year before. They look at the Madison, guys finished 13th, and they just had us as, you know, possible bronze medal chance. But we knew that we were, you know, like dead set podium potential. And we thought that we could win. But, you know, all the broadcasters and the media, they just had us down as, you know, rank outsiders because we're only good enough to run 13th at the Worlds the year before. So, nah, we're better than that.
I once did a Madison training camp with Brett Aitken. He came to, it was like in 2011, I think, and me and Jesse Sargent had just done a full season in Europe, and we flew from Europe after our last race straight to Invercargill, the bottom of the South Island, for 2 weeks, a two-week track camp. It was like Olympic, start of the Olympic process, you know. But the first week was this Madison camp with Brett Aitken, and Jesse and I were like, we were pissed off we had to go to it. Like, I wanted to go. I hadn't been home for 10 months. I was like, can't I just, me and Jesse just go home for a week and then come in for the team pursuit part? Like, why do we need to do the Madison camp? Like, neither of us rode Madisons. We just purely rode team pursuits. And we had no option. We had to go. And so we were down there with Brett Aitken, and me and Jesse were just so over it. And like, probably a bit shit for Brett. But we just like, me and Jesse just went to the pub every night. Like, we'd turn up to practice the next day for this Madison camp, like hungover. And Brett would be trying to tell us, like, okay, you got to change like every lap and a quarter or whatever, lap and three quarters or whatever the technique is, and change on the bankings. And me and Jesse just changing in the middle of the straights, and like sometimes we're doing four laps, sometimes one of us is doing one lap. Like, we're just like all over the show. We just didn't want to be there. And then at the end of that week was the National Madison Champs, and everyone else had been practicing, you know, like getting their technique right. And, you know, like Brett would be like showing us videos, like, look, you know, this is a great change by Archibald and Scully. Like, that's how you should do it, rah, rah. And then we finished the camp with the Madison National Madison Champs, and Jesse and I won it. And everyone else was like, what the fuck? I didn't even do the camp. I just at the pub the whole week. Yeah, that was when I met Brett. Yeah,
also what I enjoy, because the rules have changed now for the Madison. So it used to be that, you know, if you took a lap, you were a lap up and you were going to win the race, right? And three teams take a lap, you know, then the one with the most points wins the race. Now, it doesn't matter. If you take a lap, you get 20 points, and they sprint every 10 laps now, so there's even more sprints. So basically it means the team that's the strongest, the hardest, the one that attacks the most now definitely is going to win. So it's geared towards absolutely the most experienced, strongest teams that can win, which would have favoured me, but I actually like the fact that you can be the eighth best team, you know, technically, you know, on paper, maybe the eighth best team in the race, sit in, don't contest the sprints, and then go whack, take a lap at the right moment and take your opportunity and then win. So if you want to win the race, yeah, you've got to look after all the best teams and make sure you go for all the sprints, but you've also got to be thinking about those teams you haven't seen for the last 35 laps, right? Where are they? Why are they not at the front? Are they going to attack us? Get ready for it. And when they do, bam, you've got to chase them down as well. I like the old format. It created opportunity. And the French won a couple of times. You know, they weren't the best team on the track, but they attacked at the right time. Good on them. You know, it rewards opportunity. It's like the Kiesenhofer winning the road race, the women's road race last week. Good on her. You know, she went in the early break, never succeeds, but she went all the way and won a gold medal. Bloody great.
I said get in the break, just the wrong. It's the women's race I meant, not the men's. I tried to tell George, but
yeah,
it was the women's race, really.
Yeah, but if George got in the break in the men's race, it might have gone all the way.
That's
just
right.
Could have changed the dynamic, yeah.
Hey, one thing I want to ask you is both you guys have been in multiple Olympics. With the COVID year, do you feel sorry that these athletes that have the success, they have missed that crucial period, which is if you win gold, you can go out on a bender, you can go to these parties, you can live it up. They don't get that experience. I mean, what was that like in Sydney, Scooter, when you win gold and there's that relief, but you can go and celebrate and have the freedom to bloody do it?
Mm. Yeah, that's part of the games. Look, it's not just the piss up at the end of it that's part of the games, but the whole thing of having family, friends, you know, the camaraderie within the national team, it wouldn't be there. Like, we've got that similar situation even here with the commentary crew. We would normally hang out at the end of each day, have a few drinks, tell some stories, whatever. None of that, right? We're all keeping separate because everyone's nervous that someone's going to get a cough and, you know, maybe someone tests positive because they've bloody gone to, you know, some local pub, whatever, it becomes a hot spot. Even if you don't test positive, you have to isolate, you know, and can't do your job until you test negative. Everyone's nervous about that.
Are you in Tokyo now?
No, I'm in Melbourne. I'm in Melbourne. Yeah.
So that you're in a real plot twist day for the show.
Yeah.
I'm actually there. Oh, fuck.
So we're in Melbourne. Melbourne's gone through all this lockdown stuff as well, right? So it's even working on it from here, which was going to be difficult, but we still don't have the camaraderie that we would have even had because all the commentators are here in Melbourne. There's a couple up in Sydney, but most of them are here, and the hosts, TV hosts, et cetera. So we don't have that kind of feeling. For the athletes, absolutely. And all of them are jumping on planes the day after to fly home, you know, wherever, all around the world. No one's allowed to hang around. So even by the end of the games, you think about it, by the end of the games, there'll be stuff all athletes even there. So if you're running or competing, say, you know, the track cyclists now, so if they, by the time everybody's competed and you do the last of the Madisons, so for example, by the time you've finished the Madison, if you win it, three quarters of your teams from the track have probably already left, and definitely, you know, more than three quarters of the entire national Olympic team have already left. So there'd be the skeleton marathon on the ground.
The marathon's a good example of that because the marathon, well, I don't know if it still is, but in Beijing and London was always the last event of the Olympic Games.
They'd
be in the food hall at like 6 a.m. having their pre-race oats and stuff, and they'd be like 5,000 pissed athletes who have just come back from the pub fucking throwing chicken nuggets at each other's heads. And like these marathon runners are just sitting there going like, fuck, we're still going to compete. But like, I bet they'll miss that this year because they'll, like you say, Scotty, they'll be sitting in the village eating their oats and they'll be like, there's no one here except the marathon runners. You know, like
everyone would have gone.
And the best thing about the Olympics, like, in Beijing especially, the parties were awesome. Like we partied for a week or 10 days after we won the medal there before we went back to New Zealand with athletes from, you know, all shapes and sizes, all different countries, all different sports. So much fun. But like you say, with the family, like that was the best night of the whole, best thing of the whole Olympics was none of us had seen our families for a long time. We crossed the line. We won a bronze that night. We're at an Irish pub in Beijing with all our families, you know, the whole team with mum and dad, grandma and granddad, brothers and sisters. Mm. And it was just such a ripping night, you know? And, like, you got to celebrate it with the people that you really wanted to celebrate it with before you went out there and ran amok for 10 days. But you see the Olympics this year that they're all seeing their families on those TVs. They've got their athlete camp.
Yeah.
That's something at least, but it's just not the same as giving the old man a hug when you've won a medal, you know?
But as that should be the best part of the journey is if you can achieve the dream – the celebration, if you can't celebrate and you can't live it up, then I don't see the point. Because so many athletes look back, the ones that regret it, and go, I never celebrated the victories enough. And I remember, I can't remember her name now. This is bad. This is real bad.
Aussie?
I went to – no, she was Dutch and she won the World Time Trial Championship in 2013. Female.
Oh, 2013.
No.
Time trial
at the Worlds in 2013.
Chantal Black.
I can't remember her name. This is bad. Anyway, we're 2013. Can you Google that?
Oh, Van Dyke. Alan Van Dyke.
Van Dyke. And so we went to Curacao. And I went there with the wean dog, all expenses paid, and she was there, and we're all on the beers and that. And I said to her, hey, you don't drink. And she goes, no, I don't really drink. I said, but you've drunk before, yeah? And she goes, yeah, I don't mind drinking every now and then, but no, not really. I said, okay, I want to ask you a question. When you won the Worlds, did you go out and celebrate that night? She goes, no. Within half an hour, I was already thinking of winning the Worlds next year. And I just looked at her, and I was half cut at the time, and I said, that is fucking sad. And she goes, what do you mean? I said, that's fucking sad. If you can't let rip, you're a world champion. And I was going to not swear on this show, but fuck it. I said, you're the world champion. If you can't celebrate that, what is the point? And she goes, oh, it's your, oh, no. Shh, quiet. What is the point? I said, tonight we're going to celebrate the fact that you're world champion. And we let rip. We absolutely ripped it a new one. And the next day she said to me, she goes, I feel like dog shit. You know, I've been praying to the porcelain gods all morning, but it was worth it because that's what it's all about. If you can't enjoy the success, what the fuck is the point? I don't get it. I don't get it, Scooter.
Well, I'd imagine the Kiwis are the same. So they're all getting on planes and coming back, going straight into 2 weeks quarantine. Okay, so if you've won a gold medal or a medal and you've done a personal best, then you've got that each day to think about, like, oh, well, in 2 weeks, but, you know, you're on a high, you're feeling good about yourself. If you've had a bad performance and something's gone wrong, or even if you were challenged mentally going into the games and things didn't go the way you'd like it to, you come back after chasing your dream and not obtaining it to 14 days in quarantine.
Mm.
Imagine the mental state of some of these athletes.
At least it's, you know, free.
Going through, yeah, possibly shit food, but yeah, there could be
a fine line, isn't it?
They really need to, yeah, I think they really need to be very careful on how we look after the athletes, keep in touch with them, and just check on their mental health in the next 3-4 months. You know, time. The female boxer, we had you wouldn't have seen it, Bules. We had a female boxer that got beaten, and she just broke down, right? And you can imagine how tough boxers are, right? All sports people are tough, but boxers is a bit different, isn't it? And she just broke down and said that, you know, she just let everybody down. She's devastated and crying and really emotional. Now, she's sitting in hotel quarantine in that state of mind for 14 days.
I spoke about it last week on the show, the post-Olympic depression, and you would have had it as well, Scooter. Yeah. Like, it's a real thing, you know? Like, you build up for so many years, all this pressure, all this hype around the Olympics. You go to the Olympics, you have success or you don't. And when it's all over, you know, like, let's say for us, if you win a medal, you're like, you finish it, then there's media, then there's people wanting to, you know, talk to you, and then there's family there, you're having a party, and then eventually you come back to Rotorua like I did, and you sit down and go, man, all that, it's all over now. Like, I'm flat as, you know? And it's a real thing. And like, exactly, it's a really good point that you make, is that these people are going to have that, and they're going to have it immediately, and they're going to have it by themselves in a hotel room. Like,
They're going to have it worse.
I hope I didn't even think about it until you mentioned it, but it's a really good point. I hope that and I'm sure that a lot of the Olympic committees will have some techniques in place, even if it's just as simple as a roommate, you know? You know, at least go there and, you know, room with your counterpart, or, you know, go through it, have someone to talk to at least. But yeah, it's going to be tough.
Well, Jeremy, I would say that the one roommate I wouldn't want to have would be with a depressed boxer.
Yeah.
Back off. Imagine I'm huddling in the corner every day. No, you can have the extra toast.
Jerry Seinfeld made a joke about it, and that was about the swimmers. And he said, you know, you train 4 years, and it comes down to like a finger touch. Like, you know, like 1/100th of a second, 4 years building up for that. Like, that must mental bloody health. That must just absolutely cook you. Because especially if you review, like, there was a swimmer for Australia, and Ian Thorpe did the review, and he said he went for a breath just before he did the finger touch. If he didn't do that breath and just, like, lent out and just – that could have been a difference. The wrong lane, because he didn't, like, go hard enough in the semi beforehand or whatever – and he could have, because he breathed to the right side, and he could see his opponents. That was a difference. All these things that when you go home, and as you said, Scooter, you've got to do the 2 weeks quarantine. Man, the mental fog, that's just going to be going through your head over and over. Yeah. And what would make it worse is people around you going, cheer up, mate. You gave it all you got. She'll be right, mate. But, oh, fuck, shut up. Fucking let me grieve.
Yeah, no, it's true. I slightly different scenario for me, right? So because, you know, my process into Sydney was just trying to get the job done because of the lead-in that I had, okay, right? So for those that don't know, you know, my son passed away 2.5 months before the Sydney Games. So I had given up back then thinking that I wasn't mentally going to be able to put myself through what's required to be competitive, and I'd had a shit lead-up to it before that. You know, I thought I had, right? Mentally I didn't think I'd trained enough, and I'd been back and forth to Europe and everything while things weren't going well. So I had 6 months of pretty average training as far as I believed. So getting to the Games was simply just putting Band-Aids on everything emotionally to try and at least just tick that box, get it done, then be a grieving parent, okay? That was the process that I was trying to go through. Then when we won home games, first track cycling gold medal for 16 years for Australia, and it's in Sydney, and it was just media, bam, 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 all this attention, how great's this? And then there'd be a touch on the story and people then realising, because we kept everything not under wraps, but, you know, nothing was promoted or talked about and it was all low key. And then once the media got hold of it, it's like, oh, what a great story. This is emotional, blah, blah, blah. Mm. So you're under all this attention, which was good attention, okay? And then I had to do the road race as well, so I had to focus on that for, you know, a week later, did the road race. Then after the game, stayed in Australia for, you know, another couple of weeks, did the Herald Sun tour, more attention, everything's great, getting pumped up, had bloody sponsorship deals coming in, it was all going well. Then went back to Europe to do the 6 days. So I went to the World Championships, then straight into the 6 days. You know, my wife came with me. So then another batch of each 6 day was friends and associates and colleagues from different parts of the world pumping up your tyres, patting you on the back. This is great. This is great. You've overcome something, you know, that was amazing. And then came back to Australia in December for Christmas. Everything was going okay. Then I went back to Europe for the second part of the 6 day season that year. And my wife stayed back in Australia. So then I went back over on my own. This is now, you know, 6 months after he'd passed away and, 4 months after the Olympics, that I, for the first time, actually went anywhere on my own and went to the first race, Brayman 6 day, went well. I was in great form, right? So I think I might have won it, podium if didn't. And then went back between that race to the next race. We had 3 days between Bremen and Stuttgart, 6 day event. So I went back to my apartment in Cologne for the first time, and it was the first time in that whole period where I had spent more than one night actually alone with no one else.
Mm.
Mate.
That's when it hit you.
It was traumatic. Mm. I was fetal position for 3 days.
Mm. And is
then,
that a hard
thing? Went to the next race. Then just picked myself up, went to the next race. And then now it's broken, right? So I cracked the shell at that moment. You know, and mentally I don't know. I understand these things a lot more now, but I cracked the shell, right? So the damn wall had been put up. You know, leaks were coming through, but those 3 days was boom, snap it open. There's something really traumatic that's happened that hadn't been addressed. Then I had to go to the next race, and you know, I won it with Matthew Gilmore. We won the Stuttgart 6 day, but every night I was going back to my hotel to bawl my eyes out. And I was doing it as quickly as I could because I was sharing a room and I didn't want my roommate to know that I was so mentally unstable. Get to the track the next day, superstar Olympic champion, flying around the track, going really strong, winning, back to the hotel again to bawl my eyes out the next night. There's a lot of shit that doesn't get dealt with that comes out eventually. It comes out eventually. And that's what I'm worried about with a lot of these athletes.
That's what I was going to say. That experience that you've gone through, and it was a long period ago, but you never forget it. But is that give you the ability to understand on a deeper level, hey, hang on, you know, the isolation is the biggest problem when it comes to this mental health. We take the piss on this podcast all the time about write 2021 off and all this sort of stuff, but it's real. You know, it's a real issue in terms of isolation is the worst thing when it comes to mental health. When you can't discuss issues, you don't have people to connect with, you are in quarantine, you're on your own, you're in lockdown, all this sort of stuff, that is the number one issue when it comes to progressing or getting through really tough moments.
Yeah, I think you don't, when you're in isolation, you don't have anything to distract you you don't have anything to distract you from yourself, and you have to sit with yourself in whatever, you know, and that might be if you're in a great state of mind, that's fantastic. You can deal with that, okay? But if you're in a bad place, you sit in shit with yourself for that period of time, and things get much, much worse and much darker. And there, you know, some people with the right tools can work their way through that, perhaps. But I think it's quite dangerous and I know what it can be like to sit in your own stench and have to deal with your own stuff without being distracted. And to be distracted isn't the right way to do it, but it can at least keep you moving forward. So I think keeping these athletes maybe distracted for these 2 weeks is something that we should be really trying to do to help them through, so that they can actually get some help once they get through it.
Well, they can come on our podcast as many of them as they like.
They can do that. That'd be a good way. Hey, we've got a bit serious there, guys. I'm not sure if that's the standard.
No, it's good. That was really good.
I think a lot of people.
It's true. It's 100% true as well. Like I would think, and I would hope that, you know, the New Zealand Olympic Committee and the Australian Olympic Committee will have some techniques in place, or at least, you know, someone they can pick up the phone and talk to. Like, they'd have to have acknowledged that, I'm sure.
You would hope so. They get busy too, you know, and it's resources. Mm. How many people have they got working on the program? You know, I know just in cycling within Australia, okay, there's been lots of issues with athletes that have retired after they've retired, and the association could see that there could be some issues, but they just didn't have the resources to follow up. Like, once an athlete's retired, you know, the New Zealand Federation is the same situation. You're focusing on the next athlete that can potentially win new medals at the next Olympics. So we don't, and I know in AFL footy in Australia, they're pretty good because they have the resources. They've got so much money and so many employees that they can have people to help out retiring or retired players to help them make that next transition into, you know, the real world. We don't have that in cycling, especially in Australia.
Not in government-funded sports, so.
No. And it's not to say that they don't know that they need it. I'm sure, you know, people within Oz Cycling definitely, the modern version of Oz Cycling, they know that we do need that, just don't have the resources to actually follow it through.
Mm.
Well, that's the thing. Resources, it's going to be huge, because it's not just like, all right, let's chat to this athlete for a month. This could be years, you know, it could be such a long journey. It's a tough one, because to get the proper resources, because a lot of people, when they are going through stuff, as we've always said, you don't like hearing people that you can't connect with. You almost need to hear it. You almost need a subcommittee of former athletes that they can connect with that go, I've been through something similar. You know, I can connect on that story. If you talk to someone in a call center going, okay, Steve, tell me about your problems. Yeah, you didn't get them, but you'll be right. Piss off, you know. Like, they need to hear it from someone that's been through similar stuff. And maybe, Scooter, that's an opportunity moving forward to present something to, like, Australian Athletic Committee, because we're in a different era, man. Like, on the back of the COVID and stuff, this is going to be, like, much more of an issue, and people are a lot more comfortable now being in touch with, particularly males, let's be honest. Males, we're shithouse. We are shithouse when it comes to talking about issues, getting things out in the open. And the more you get in a routine of being comfortable being vulnerable, being comfortable to talk to a mate on a deeper level, to go, hey, mate, I'm fucking struggling, man. Like, I'm dealing with anxiety, I'm dealing with this, or I feel like shit today, or whatever. It's a hard process. And, we don't often get deep on this show, guys. But when we do, we call it as we fucking see it, because we've all gone through shit. It's just the depth that varies, you know.
When we do get deep, we go to the bottom. We go right.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, but you're spot on. You're totally spot on. It's just explaining my, you know, going to that Stuttgart 6 day, you know, and hiding from my roommate, who was a good friend, you know, and I'm sure he would have understood, but there was no way I was going to show any vulnerability to anyone. You know, my family, I'm not going to show vulnerability to my competitors that may be still friends. I'm not going to, no way.
But that era as well, Scooter, it was still stuck in the past, early 2000s. Yeah. Like, you didn't do that. That's not what guys did. And you're seeing it in modern cycling. Even sports directors now are wanting to connect more with the athletes. And it's in every sport. You know, they're wanting to show that they've got a human side. A lot of coaches are opening up vulnerabilities, you know.
The fact that arguably the most famous Olympian at the current Olympic Games in Tokyo, Simone Biles, the fact that she's in a position where she feels comfortable to withdraw from the Olympics when she's the golden girl of the Olympics, it's good. You know,
yeah,
it's a shame that she had to withdraw from the. She's chosen to withdraw from the Olympics because she was obviously in line to win a lot of gold medals, but she identified that, and she's actually really cool, eh? Like I watched this press conference with her the other day when she was talking about it, and like she was just kind of like she was really chilled and really relaxed about it, and like super candid about it all, and like she wasn't like sitting there in tears going like. It's been so tough, the pressure cooker, and like, you know, I just haven't been able to handle it. And, you know, there's so much expectation on me. Like, she was actually just like, you know what, man, like, I don't feel up for it. Like, and I don't really care what anyone thinks. Like, yeah, I know I could win a shitload of gold medals. I know there's people that are disappointed in me that they, you know, they wanted me to come here and do that. But honestly, in gymnastics, you've got to be fucking on. And I'm not. I can't get my head straight. And so it's not right for me to compete. I'd rather give it to somebody else and wish them all the best. And, you know, I haven't got an injury. I'm all good. I'm just not up for it. So, sayonara.
Yeah.
It's becoming so much more acceptable. And I said for Osaka, you know, similar sort of things. Like when she was withdrawing from French, everyone's going, that's bloody weak. And then she put her hand up and she said, no, I'm struggling. I've got mental health issues. Everyone started going, ooh, hang on. Hang on, we need to understand this, you know, instead of just getting on the front foot and going, you withdrew or whatever. Mate, that's what it's all about. Just when you're not feeling right, just put your hand up. Like people will support you no matter what.
So we got Schwatter, Wayne Schwoss, former AFL player here in Australia, in Melbourne, Victoria, who's really outspoken and vocal, you know, and he does a lot on it. And he was quite vocal about people criticizing Naomi as well after the French, you know, and he talks about, you know, and I can relate because, yeah, he talks about coming home from training. Like he was best and fairest in North Melbourne, I think twice, when Wayne Carey was there. Okay, so that's how good a player he was. But he said he'd drive home from training and he wouldn't understand why he would do this. He didn't think that there was anything in particular that he was challenged by, but he would pull over to the side of the road and just bawl his eyes out. And he's like, what the fuck? And as a footballer back then in the 90s, you're not going to tell anyone that. No way. And he didn't understand why he was feeling like that. But, yeah, we're starting to get a grip now that, you know, these things happen. And I know from my own experience because I was trying to avoid it as much as I could. And the only person I really – once I started to talk a bit more about these things and there was, you know, family issues and things that have all sort of exploded because of all of this stuff that I'd put myself through without getting any help. So it's my own fault for what has ended up happening later in my life. But the psychiatrist that I end up really, you know, connecting with was a former ultra marathon world championship competitor. And I, because just touching on what you said, Dan, before, I connected to him, didn't know who he was, but the fact that he's someone that has been an athlete at that level, and he talked to Dan like, oh, you know, you're an Olympic gold medalist. I'm like, mate, you're an ultra marathon runner. You went to the world championships in that discipline. I'm fascinated by that. I'm respectful of you because of your commitment to your sport, which is something I can't do. It's awesome. But I just had this immediate respect for him that at least – he will understand some of the extra challenges, okay? So, you know, son's passing, all those sorts of things are hard. But I felt like I was torn between being selfish and continuing to chase my dreams as an athlete after having to go through what I just went through, and am I just now being really selfish and stupid, you know, and you add that all on top of it. But he could understand the whole I felt that he could understand the sporting side of it and the pressures of the Olympic Games on top of it. So I was happy to really open up. And I didn't want to talk to someone that didn't have that level of understanding. Now, that might be stupid and ignorant, and that's not to say people that haven't been to the Olympics or been an elite athlete don't know, you know, anything about it. You know, I think there are plenty of the people do, but just the way I processed it was I felt like I needed someone that had been an elite sports person. And that was wrong. Like I was wrong in thinking that, but that did help me.
I think one of the keys as well is if you are someone that has been through something sort of traumatic, come out the other side, when you're talking with someone that is in the thick of it, you know, they're really struggling, is not to preach, because when they're in the thick of it, sometimes a lot of people get their back up when they're being told what to do. You just got to be a good listener. You just got to sit there. That a lot of the time, a lot of people, when they're in the thick of it, they just need someone to listen to it. and then just to help them over time to develop strategies on moving forward. Because the key thing is with all of that stuff is people get caught in what has happened in the past that you can't change. And that's what creates the almost like a bloody Ferris wheel. You can't change it. And the mental chatter just does your head in because you're like, I wish this was it. Oh, guess what? It's not going to change. And it, the ability to focus on the forward, the next steps and all that sort of stuff is key. But when you're talking to people, this is from my experience, that are in the thick of it, don't just keep going, yeah, but guess what I did? And this is what I piss off. You just got to be a listener. And then over time, when they're ready, then you can help them to go, well, if you're comfortable with me telling you this, one thing I tried is this. And it's a lot easier approach because when you are mates with people and you see them struggling, you just want to help them. You don't want to see them going through it. But yeah. It's hard to develop that strategy because I fell into that trap, you know, 6 months ago. I would then see mates struggling and go, hey, yeah, mate, this is what I'm doing. I'm going walking out and doing all this. And they're like, mate, who do you think you are? Like, you know, the second coming of Christ here. Like, just chill out. But that's, yeah, I mean, we could talk for hours about this sort of stuff. But the key thing is if you are struggling or you are going through sort of talk about it, get off your chest, vent, you know, find a network. Don't go through the isolation of it because, as we said, particularly after last year, Bills, everyone's going through a layer of shit. It's just the depth that varies, you know. And as you said before, Scooter, like the athletes are the ones we take the piss all the time on this show, but you're still dealing with humans, you know. You're still dealing with real issues. You know, you talked about interviews where people saying they let each other down, like those Aussie BMXers. And the athlete, the female whose brother had been in a horrific crash, and she got taken out, and all she could think is, I've just let everyone down. And straight away your brain would be going, hey, hey, hang on, shit, this is going to be processed now. 4 years to build up for that, and now she's in that mindset. That's going to take a long time.
Yeah, Saya Sakakibara, yeah. Mm. Yeah. So Japanese-Australian, the Olympic Games in Japan. They love her over there. Her first international races as a kid was for Japan, not Australia. She had to actually brush up on her English when she moved back to Australia. So she's got double whammy pressure. You know, brother was going to the games. They did heaps of promo stuff before the Olympics because these siblings were, you know, these Japanese-Australian siblings were going and they were both medal chances. You know, Saya was in second position in the race she crashed in, not the final but the semi-final to make her way through. You know, she was definitely a medal chance. And all she can think of that, you know, with all of that expectation and pressure, had a brother, even with the brother's crash, with Kai's crash the year before, she may have felt that she'd let him down. But all the media attention that she'd had over the last 18 months to 2 years, because she's this next shining light of BMX in Australia, that was what was building up on her, which came out in that interview, that I feel like I've let everybody down. Well, you haven't let anyone down. Okay, we know that, but it's interesting how all these external pressures build over time. And you're dealing with a 21-year-old, you know, girl from Australia who's half Japanese, and she's supposed to have the maturity levels of, you know, these experienced athletes in a situation like that where, you know, she still had a headache because she hit the ground so hard when she's doing these interviews. Mm. So, yeah, there's a lot of pressure to take on board, and they do. They just do. The athletes, they just take it on. And maybe they shouldn't, but, yeah, she's now going to spend 2 weeks in quarantine feeling that she's let Australia down.
Hey, I've taken, was, you know what I've taken on as an athlete?
This is a record episode, hour long, 23. Eh? Yeah.
Sorry.
I've taken on responsibility today of cooking a paella for 10 people. So I've got
nice.
What's really in a paella? That's the thing, isn't it? Everything in it.
That's my element. You should see the size of the pan I bought. It's a monster. So I'm
what
gonna
is going on there?
It's an element, mate. It's a gas element.
Oh, so you just hook the bottle up to that?
Hook the bottle up, chuck a big pan on there. I'm gonna fire that bad boy up the servo and cook a massive paella for the crew.
How long is it? So what's the process? Paella, is it supposed to be like this multi-hour kind of thing?
Yeah, it can be. I mean, I cook them at home quite a bit on a stovetop, so you only do it pretty quickly. But I reckon this will probably go for a few hours, I'd say, if I do it right.
There's a lot of pressure. Tour de France. Actually, I don't know if it was you, Dan, or if it was Ben. It might have been with Ben, with B-Roll, Fox Sports, and I was at the tour, and it was in the Pyrenees. So we're getting really close to French side, getting close to Spain and Paella territory. But the pan, just in Bangers and Luchon or whatever one of those names are, and the pan was like, you know, it was like dinner table kind of size, you know, just in, there's when you go in and, you know, pay you $4 or whatever, get a thing. Amazing. The stuff's brilliant. Don't know what was in it, but it was good.
There's pressure when you're cooking bulk bules because if you screw up, it's on a grand scale. So you want to make sure you follow that playbook like to a T.
I don't use a recipe or instructions.
Gut shot,
mate. Nah, I do it at home, but so I reckon I'm not worried. I think it's going to be fine. I'm that confident. I've done quite a few paellas, so I reckon I back myself. The good thing is you can't really fuck it up because you just add more broth if you need to.
Yeah.
Let it cook a bit longer. But the problem is the rice doesn't absorb it then. So then you might end up with a paella soup.
Is this your signature dish, paella, or is there something else that?
It's becoming one of them. Yeah, I love it.
Are you going to do a video of it, Bules?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. I think you need to get back on the cooking video horse.
Close to rain the Savo, so it's going to be that'll be a bit of a hassle. But
we don't need as much broth then.
That's true.
just rain water, mate.
But we got a garage. I'll do it in the garage if you need it. So we'll be right. Righto. It's been a long show. I got to go. I got shit to do.
Lasagna, mate. Slow lasagna. Cooked, right. Red wine broth, like ragu. Perfect, mate. Mine's monster a, show.
Monster eats.
Yeah,
I've got to drive out to my mates. Do you guys want to know what I'm doing for the rest of the day? I'm going to finish this podcast. I'm going to drive out to my friend's house to pick up a gas hose that I need. Then I'm going to drive home. Then I'm going to cut up a fucking shitload of chicken, and then I'm going to take all of my equipment to Mitch Docker's house, and I'm going to cook a paella. And then I'm going to come home. Then I'm going to pack my suitcase, and then I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning. I'm going to go to Walter Burgos.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
Mate, you literally are cooking with gas.
Like, share, subscribe. Thanks for coming on, Scooter.
Like, share, subscribe. Good on you, Scooter. That was awesome.
Cheers, guys.
Mate.
Pleasure.
Olympic gold medalist, Scott McGorry, Madison, Sydney 2000. Don't forget. Never forget.
Hey, bronze medalist, Team Pursuit. We like our bronze medals, don't we, Bills, in the teams?
13th in the Madison World Champs, 1999 or 2000 also.
Like, share, subscribe.
Like, share, subscribe. Ciao.